Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. I am going to start off by not pointing at me, because I'm not that important. I'm just this guy who's listening to my much, much cooler cohort on both sides of the ocean over here. Let's go ahead and start with Mike. How are you doing, Mike? Don't acknowledge me. Just talk about yourself because you're so cool.
I was about to say, I'm doing great, but are you okay? Because that sounded like surprisingly sort of low self-esteem kind of sound there, which is, in your case, not at all merited. But you are too modest, but I'm doing great. It's what we call second or third summer in Los Angeles. So we're back to wearing shorts and opening the window, or sometimes closing the window because it's too hot. And I expect to enjoy that for another 48 hours or so before things change abruptly again.
Cool, cool. Actually, not that cool. It's more like 92 degrees over here, which is, sorry, Alex, I don't know what that is in Celsius, but how are you doing?
I'm doing quite fine, thanks. I'm on over on this side of the ocean. It is, getting rather dark. Up here in Scandinavia, the days are getting noticeably shorter. In Los Angeles, do you have daylight saving in California or on the West Coast there?
We do.
Sadly, yes. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Well, actually, our daylight saving time finishes this weekend, which means that we gain 1 hour on Sunday, which will be exciting. On a side note, I am getting increasingly itchy to come to Los Angeles to visit you guys because, I'm the guy who says Los Angeles, unlike anyone else in the entire world, of course, who call it LA. I'm the guy who calls it Los Angeles. Anyway, outside of Europe and Australia, for obvious reasons, oh, and Japan, it's getting lower and lower on the list. Los Angeles is my number one wish list destination right now because I don't know. I just have it's one place in the United States that I've never been, and I know a fair few people there, and of course, you two wonderful people included there. But yeah, I just, it hasn't been helped by the fact that one of my very close colleagues at Moon Mode, she's actually going to LA week after next, I think, for a 2-week holiday. So not feeling so great about that. Somewhat jealous, but anyway, I'm fine, Vince. Sorry.
Oh, wait a minute, you acknowledged me. No, it's okay. It's okay. Well, I'm sorry that you are not taking a wonderful 2-week vacation in Los Angeles, but hopefully that will happen in the near future. It does look like things, here I am gesturing broadly into the microphone, are getting better. So hopefully soon we will get the crew back together. We will hang out, have fun. Los Angeles is a great place.
We're very overdue another Game Audio Hour get together, barbecue, or some event like that. So we definitely need to import Alex so that we can accomplish this.
That'd be great. Import, yeah. Put me in a crate. Nail up the crate. Send it over.
Wait a minute. Isn't that what former CEO of Nissan did a few months back?
Oh, yeah. That's right. What's it? Grossen?
Gosen? Something Gosen, like that.
Yeah. It wasn't a few months. It was actually about a few years ago, I think. But yeah, that's right. There was a... He actually... I'm surprised that you know about that, Vince. Actually, no, I'm not surprised that you know about that.
I do like Japanese cars, so... Weird things like that definitely stick out in my memory.
That is very, very weird. But let's talk about game audio, shall we?
Okay.
See what that's like.
Yeah, game audio is pretty cool.
So, Mike, you were mentioning before our show started in the green room, you were hoping to give us a little bit of an update into your exciting lo-fi, universal, future-proof patch library, preset management, help me out here, system.
My primitive patch management system. So
totally future-proof.
as a disclaimer, this will be boring to 80% of the listeners. But for the remaining 20%, this is your moment. Basically, I've been trying to find a way to organize patches and sounds in Logic. And Logic gives you a bunch of ways to do this. You can save channel strips. You can save patches. You can save presets within a given plugin. But what I'm really looking for is something that's just a little more accessible and where I can somehow survey what I've got and find what I need at a given moment. And I find the process of taking every preset in a plugin, you know, within the plugin's own native browsing, sound browsing thing, where you open the plugin and you use whatever interface they may have come up with, and then saving each one of those as a patch in Logic or a channel strip is just incredibly fatiguing. And the process of loading a patch can actually take 5 to 10 seconds, depending on what you've got instantiated on the channel strip. So if you're doing something like, if you're loading a sound whose nature you know in advance, like an orchestral sound, it's fine. Because you know what you want. You have a good sense of what that library's oboe sounds like versus this library's oboe. And you probably know your library well. But when you're looking at sounds, they're a little less well-defined. Synth sounds, things that have sound design-y elements to them, effects, stuff like that. I find it just takes forever. And often I want to have a palette for project. Some people like to actually set up a template file. I find that a little cumbersome. So a year or so ago, I experimented with what I call my super low-tech patch management system, which is laughably primitive, but I would open up a Omni Outliner document, which is just a structured outlining software, and literally make lists of patches that I would organize in whatever way my brain wanted to organize them. So if I might say game level 3 ambient sounds, I would literally just type a list. And then if I wanted to load something, I would go into the search field in Logic, which lets you search through your library of whatever, instead of doing the drill down browsing approach. And I found that through this two-step process, it was actually a lot easier than loading and saving a billion presets for every single plugin and then waiting to load them up. Logic's patch browser does not have tagging. It does not have any way of writing a comment. So you can't just jot down a note and then quickly see those notes when you're browsing patches, right? So like, it's as laughable as a sound, I would often rename the patches with things like, you know, hit C4 for that bass drum that has that nice resonance. And that would literally be like the name of the patch. Yeah. So I would make just a list in Omni Outliner. And I found that that was sort of okay. I would literally look at my list and it would be organized by however I happen to think of sounds for a particular project. Then right, I discovered.
Sorry, before you go on, can I just ask a clarifying question there?
Please.
That you said that your patches are organized in an outline in Omni Outliner or something like that. Then you're basically just searching for the name of the patch using Logic's search functionality, right?
Exactly.
What exactly is Logic searching through? Is it searching through its own, your own saved patch, like Logic patch list? Or is it searching, does Logic actually index the presets of all of the, like, for example, if you have like a VSD or an AU synth, and then it has its own patch library, which is stored in somewhere on your system. And of course, every one of those synths is going to do it in a different place in a different way, annoyingly. Does Logic have a way to actually index all of those so that in this one search field, it's universal in the sense that you can just type in the name and it will actually go through and give you results for all of the presets for all of those soft synths? Or is it only searching through a list of your patches?
Wouldn't that be nice? Logic does provide a list of patches for the things that come with Logic. So if you instantiate Alchemy, for example, and then if you can visualize Logic's interface, which I know you probably can't, but some of our listeners can, there's a little blue arrow next to Alchemy's the plugin where it appears on a channel strip. And if you, I think, click to the left of Alchemy, a browser window will open and it'll show you everything that Alchemy has got built in it. And for any arbitrary plugin, you can also set up your own. There's actually three levels of preset-like things in Logic. There's AU presets, which are specific to a given plugin. Then there are, there's kind of the old system of channel strip settings, which were, I guess I would describe them as being agnostic to what plugin it is. It's just literally a channel strip, which can have a plugin, which can have effects and whatever else, but it can be used as a de facto way of saving a patch if your plugin has a particular, if you load in a patch. All right, so let's say you've got Contact and you load in Nose Flute number 4 and you save that as a channel strip. Logic doesn't really know or care what instrument is in Contact, but since Contact happens to be instantiated on that channel strip, it can serve as a kind of de facto preset for Nose Flute number 4.
I see.
And finally, there's the newer system, which are patches, which are just like channel strips, except they add some proprietary stuff that was added in later versions of Logic, such as articulation sets and control center stuff and other goodies. Anyway, the answer to your question is actually no. There's what appears when you type into the search window is dependent on context. So if you are if you've clicked on a particular plugin, you will see the settings that are saved from that plugin. If you are looking at a channel strip, I wish Logic were in front of me. I'll give you a simpler answer. It's contextual, and no, Logic does not automatically scrape all the patches out of every single plugin that you own and create one unified indexed searchable list. If that were the case, I wouldn't have to do any of this.
Yeah, so does that mean in your case, this is actually a two-step process? So you, let's say you have a synth, you play a patch and you think, oh, this is nice, I like this one. You make a note of the name of the patch in your outline document for future indexing in whatever logical place that you want to put it or logical category. But then within Logic, in order to actually enable you to find that with the universal search, you need to save like a channel strip or a Logic patch of that synth with that preset. Is that how it works? It's like a two-step process?
Correct, in terms of the setup. The exception being if you're using something that comes with Logic, all of its presets tend to magically be populated whenever you look at the plugin, which is very handy, actually, with things like the guitar amp plugin. It's not limited to instruments. It also applies to effects. That's one of the many ways that Logic is biased towards its own native plugin processing set.
Right. Sorry, I pulled you off your train of thought there. Please continue.
Anything to make this exciting, I'm all for. Like if you just want to start humming in the background. But anyway, the update to all of this is I was using Omni Outliner. And the problem with that approach is what if you think of a patch in two different contexts? Like, for example, let's say I've got some cool drum impact and I think of, okay, and I'm working on a particular project. I'll save on my primitive Omni Outliner list. I'll have like drum effects I'm using in this particular game scoring gig. But I might also want to add that drum sound to, I like it so much, I want to consider it one of my greatest hits. How's that for a bad joke? I'll consider that like kind of a core go-to sound that I want to use in a lot of projects. Well, I can either make a duplicate list somewhere, you know, I can copy and paste the entry for that little drum sound somewhere else, but then you start to get the double entry fatigue where you're, you know, maintaining copies of information. And if you, what if you change your annotation for it here? Do you want to change it for there somewhere else? So I discovered a really cool way to work around this. And I ditched Omni Outliner and started using Bear. And Bear is something that I think only exists for Mac. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it's intended as a kind of substitute for the stock notation program that comes, the notes program. Sorry, not notation in the musical sense, but notes, note taking. I think that's the word I was looking for. But what Bear does is it has no folders per se. It doesn't have the traditional folder subfolder hierarchy. It just has hashtags. And you type a hashtag in a note, and it automatically creates a list of hashtags. And you can have nested hashtags that are sub-hashtags. So if you're typing a note and you type hashtag people I like / people in Sweden, it will automatically create a hashtag called people I like. And in a kind of subfoldery way, it will then create a people in Sweden hashtag. And it's automatic. You never touch this list of hashtags, which is kind of like a list of folders and subfolders. So getting back to my problem, what I found is if I have one note in the sense of you have a note-taking app and this is a textual document you're creating, per instrument, you know, here's massively cool bass drum number 4, here are my notes. I type, if you hit D above middle C, you get this big, cool resonating thing, just whatever notes are useful. And then I type hashtag percussion and then hashtag my current game project. Now that instrument appears in 2 different places, yet there's only one document. So if I edit it, I will simultaneously be editing it in all those places. So I no longer have to create copies of that note about bass drum number 5 and paste it in different contexts. I just add another hashtag. So the takeaway from this is if you want to adopt my low-tech way of just maintaining a list of patches or instruments that are organized in a way that makes sense to you, so that when you're in the middle of your project and you think, like, what are all the wind instruments I've used in this game score so far? Can I think of that as a palette? Instead of sort of laboriously saving things over and over again and waiting to load and preview them and not have any way of annotating them, you've got this list and you can use hashtags to automatically recontextualize this information across different projects or different use cases. And again, the app is called Bear, like the animal. It's free unless you want to pay for syncing and other features, in which case it has like a subscription list. But I've been using this as an upgrade to my super primitive patch logging system, and it's brilliant. It works really well, and it keeps me organized. And I feel like at any given moment, I now know what palette of sounds I want to use for a particular project, and it will be persistent in another window without, and even if I close Logic and open it again or jump from project to project, which kind of means queue to queue, I have this persistent list. It's a little bit like if you had a Vienna ensemble instantiation that was just persistent and hanging out, even if you changed projects. And in this case, it's just something massively less sophisticated than that. Anyway, it's goofy, it's weird, it's idiosyncratic. It's possible that I'm the only person in the universe who likes the system. But it is improving my creativity and my workflow, so I thought I would share with the rest of y'all.
Mike, that's actually not so primitive after all. Like it's actually quite clever. I think what you're doing there is kind of like creating, you know, like when you're doing sound design, you have your libraries of samples that are inside folders, that are inside folders, that are inside folders. But all of the actual samples themselves, the recordings have long lists of metadata that's associated with them. And then when you go to your patch, your browser or Media Explorer or whatever, you know, you just type in, for example, impact, and then any sample that has impact as one of its metadata tags will come up in one long list. It actually sounds like what you're doing is sort of like a version of that, but for your own patches. So it's not very primitive at all. It's actually quite smart, quite logical, and quite advanced, I would say.
In my knowledge, the only native sound browsing system that has this kind of tagging and organizational facility is Omnisphere, which I've looked at, and it really does actually seem to have a great organizational system for keeping track of the masses of sounds that comes with. And you can create sub-palettes for projects. If Logic could somehow steal, because Logic's really about stealing things these days, if they could just steal that organizational system and make it indigenous to Logic itself, I would be in heaven.
Yeah, actually, Cubase's browser is similar to the way Omnisphere works, in that things are all basically tagged under various different categories like that. So I think that we need Chase here to tell us, but I think also when you're saving your own presets, you can also set them up with the different categories and things so that they appear similar in the way that you've seen with Omnisphere.
Well, I might need to re-examine Cubase, because as loyal as I am to Logic, at the end of the day, workflow is everything, because all DAWs are converging on equality. And if Cubase is what you say, I might have to give it a good look.
All DAWs? Really?
Except Renoise. Vince, you use a template, right, for all of your projects? Or do you have different templates for different kind of, you know, different styles of projects or different styles of music?
I've actually been messing around with different types of templates, actual template project files, as well as Reaper's version of track templates, where you're just literally just you know, choosing and saving, and then you can import collections of tracks with plugins already on them as needed for various things. I'm still not super happy with that. I've actually been struggling with trying to find a balance between these things that I figured out, you know, these particular sound combinations that I really like and enjoy and fit well with each other, and having the freedom to just go out and grab exactly what I want when I need it and find that thing as well. Yeah, I guess for the most part, I still rely on my project template files, and I can't say I'm entirely happy with it. So I'm really glad to hear the way that you do things, Mike, even if I have to figure out about translating some of that across into different things. I was disappointed when, after saying you're moving from Omni Outliner, a Mac-only product, you are now using Bear, another Mac-only product. I'm looking at this thing and thinking, this seems like a really fantastic and elegant note-taking app that fits your needs nicely, and I would love to use it. Maybe I need to get one of those fancy new Apple Macs and try diving in there.
No, you don't need that, Vince, because there is actually an equivalent that's a web-based note-taking app called Simple Note. And Simple Note works very, very similarly to how Mike describes Bear working. Probably not exactly the same, but basically you just type a line and you add a hashtag, and then those hashtags are collected and listed up in a sidebar, basically. And then you just click them and it filters down all of your notes by whichever entry has that hashtag in it.
Oh, wow. This does look cool. Am I really just so behind the times when it comes to note-taking? I still use the old school notes because it just happens to be cross-platformish enough. And For a while, I was very diligent about keeping notes on my iPad, which would just sort of naturally sync up with notes via the category in Gmail and Google. And so I've just kept on going on that track, but maybe I need to dive into one of these things now.
Yeah, Simple Note has been around for a really long time. I remember the very first overseas business trip that I ever took when I was working in Japan. It was a business trip to the United Kingdom from Japan. And I borrowed the company's iPad, the very first model of iPad. And I remember I was looking around for like a reliable note-taking app for the iPad that had a bit more functionality than what Apple's iPad note app had at the time. And I found Simple Note, and I've actually been using it ever since. The biggest sort of limitation of it is that it's only text. You can't sort of, there's markdown support, but you cannot just sort of drag in a picture or, you know, draw something or, you know, like you can with the more modern note apps these days.
Okay.
This won't have any elucidation value for our listeners, but I just uploaded a screen cap showing a little bit of what I've been building and how you can see what my entries look like for various percussion instruments, just to give you a visual. So it seems a little less eccentric and abstract.
I'm just looking through your notes for some of your patches here. What's Rose Bowl drum W/ with FX, very diffuse and boomy, a little like your FZ boom. What is an FZ boom?
See, this has rich meaning for myself. So that refers to one of the very first feature films I ever scored, which was called The F Zone. And even though that sounds vaguely lewd, it actually was short for the Federal Zone. And in that project, we recorded a bass drum that had been packed with clothing, I think, to give it a dull thud. And what I found was, I think at that time, we were trying to simulate the effect of kind of a more of an ethnic drum than a traditional orchestral bass drum. And we recorded that. And I kept that boom because it has such a lovely, muffled, low-end sound. And it's great when you just want kind of like a whee sound without the crack of a stick hitting a membrane on a drum. So I just refer to that as FZ boom because I know, looking at it, what I mean by that. So my notation tends to be full of these arcane references to my own instrumental palette.
Brilliant. Let's move on to a different topic, because we were actually discussing another thing before the show started, which I think might be interesting to go into. I think we did talk about this quite some time ago. I mean, we've talked about everything now because we're up to episode 200 and 200 and what, Vince? What are we?
What are we on? 213?
213.
Yeah.
That's roughly 213 hours of discussion about game audio. So yes, we're probably going to be repeating ourselves here and there. But anyway, it's good to have a sort of an update on some of these topics from now and then. And the topic that I'm referring to is surround sound. Firstly, just a quick poll of all of our listeners. Please raise your hand if you have a surround sound setup for consuming games. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Well, there's a few people out there, I guess, potentially. It's interesting because, you know, I have no statistics to back this up, and this could be totally bogus, but it feels like the sort of gut intuition, it feels like the majority of consumers who play video games are using headphones.
It really does seem like that, yeah.
So I'm really curious, like, about when it comes to surround sound, which is obviously a feature that you do see in most, decently budgeted large-scale games. There will be an option for switching, in the audio options, you'll find options for different mixes, including surround sound in many, many, many cases. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience with surround sound, Vince, and not only as a developer, as an audio professional, but also as a consumer?
Surround sound is cool. I feel like surround sound is one of those things where it's been around for so long that we have all of these various rules that are ingrained in us when it comes to how to deal with surround sound. This is going to be the proper balance between the front and rear. This is how you use the center channel. This is how you use your LFE. And for all those rules, it seems like no one actually really needs it, because everything is just either messed up or totally ignored because they don't have a proper surround sound setup. It feels like it's been like that for decades now. Mm. I try to make sure that everything is all well and good on that. Even on something like a mobile game, for example. All right, I need to make sure that all of my tagging is correct. I need to make sure that my music bus in FMod is actually routed the right way so that it is not interfering with other stuff. My music bus will never go to the rears, will never go to the center, just so that I can plan ahead for when this mobile game may make its way onto a console. It's just good practice. But it's kind of funny because I, being a game audio professional, recently found out that I did not have my living room surround sound setup set up the correct way to consume surround sound. It was really bugging the crap out of me when I was hanging out with my wife, who was playing Great Ace Attorney on the Nintendo Switch, that we weren't hearing anything properly on that system. And in fact, many of the sound effects actually sounded like crap. So, you know, Ace Attorney is a pretty long series of games of, lawyering procedurals, just very fun, silly games, very goofy sort of court cases. And it has a couple of sound effects that are supposed to have a really big impact, like the big thunderous gavel from the judge. And my surround sound setup was not set up properly. And this particular sound effect was actually set up in a way so as to send that sound effect to multiple channels, not just the front left and front right, but also to the center and elsewhere. But I wasn't hearing any of that extra stuff. There wasn't any strong attack and impact at the beginning of the sound effect. And that's just because of how I set up my surround sound system. It was a combination of me not wiring the surround sound system the right way, and the lack of capability of the TV to begin with. So the Nintendo Switch, for example, they don't want to bother with paying licensing for Dolby and DTS for handling the surround stream. But they do support uncompressed surround sound. Now, uncompressed surround sound is actually a thing that many consumer systems can do, but only if you wire it the right way. Some of you out there might be familiar with the term ARC, or audio return channel. And this is a way for getting relatively small systems, especially soundbar-based sound systems, easily connected to a TV so that information can actually pass both ways down the cable. And when you do that, there's actually a limitation on how much audio bandwidth you can actually use to send audio from the TV to the soundbar. That limit is really small, 1 megabit per second, which is actually too small for doing uncompressed surround sound. So my PlayStation 4, my PlayStation 5, those things were doing surround sound no problem. But my Nintendo Switch, nope, it won't work that way because it just doesn't have enough bandwidth, even though the Nintendo Switch says, oh yeah, you can do surround. I have a surround sound-based sound bar with wireless speakers. I've got my TV, which is relatively recent. Wow, it turns out I really actually just need to upgrade my soundbar or go to a proper receiver-based surround sound system in order to get any surround sound from my Nintendo Switch, because the components I have are just slightly too old, by which I mean 2 or 3 years old, which is very infuriating to me.
Vince, do you think that for listeners out there who are working on a game soundtrack right now, let's say in a on a smaller budget project or a, an indie project, something on a smaller scale like that, if they are releasing on a platform like Steam for PCs, as I said, probably they might be safe without a surround sound mix. At what point do you think it's worthwhile sort of setting that threshold for saying, okay, beyond this point, it's going to actually be worthwhile making a specific mix or making sure that the audio engine, like the middleware that you're using or however you set things up, making sure that there is actually compatibility for people who are playing with surround setups? Is it a, like, would you draw that threshold line at consoles? Like if you're releasing a console game, then you definitely should have a surround mix, or what do you think?
I mean, that's a little tough because on one hand, consoles still represent a really big jump in your investment. Maybe it makes sense there. But specifically with the Nintendo Switch, it is really quite easy to release a game on the Nintendo Switch compared to the Nintendo systems of past. So there are a lot of indie games that are out there, and actually most of them sound pretty good. I think mostly because they're not really trying to do too much. I think that's kind of the funny irony there. When you're trying to do things that are really special and cool and wow a player with how immersive the sound is, if the player actually doesn't have that set up properly, what might end up happening is they don't just have a normal version of the sound effect. They might have an outright bad version of that sound effect coming through in their speaker. In what I was just describing with Great Ace Attorney, that sound effect is huge. When it happens, often that's accompanied by the music cutting off, other things on the screen staying completely still. That sound effect is supposed to totally take your attention. It ends up being the exact opposite in this case with my particular setup. So what does that really mean in terms of my recommendation? It kind of makes me think that you don't want to go too crazy in this case. It's different in that world. So many possibilities exist. There's VR, where you can safely assume that they are going to be either using the built-in speakers on that headset or a plugged-in set of pretty good quality headphones. That's 99.9% of users. So if you want to make something that sounds super cool and binaural and mess around with frequencies in that way to have a cool effect, mess around with sort of fun, phasey type things that you could do between the left and right speakers, I would say that's pretty safe to do. And some people might know that if you do kind of funny things with phasing and whatnot between, you know, the left and right on a stereo, you might kind of create a weird effect depending on how the system is set up. But if they're running headphones, you can do that all you want. It will sound awesome. But for people that have different types of surround systems, whether it be expensive Dolby Atmos or cheap Dolby Atmos or cheap soundbars or expensive soundbars, and then there's the possibility, the very strong possibility that these things are actually not set up properly. Ooh, it makes me think that, oh, don't go too crazy. Don't go wild on that particular effect. Don't be too daring when it comes to really highlighting the contrast of spatiality by doing something that only sounds in that rear left channel of the surround sound setup, because there's a strong possibility that not only will the person not hear it, but also the system will not be set up so as to fold it back down in a way that the player will actually be able to hear it in any way. They might not hear it at all. So now I'm thinking my advice would be, yeah, don't be too daring at all.
Vince, do you think the situation is comparable to the days of General MIDI, where you had no guarantee as to what the timbre of a given instrument might sound like on a given destination PC, and therefore there was a lack of predictability of the basic audio sound of a game?
Maybe. I mean, there definitely was a really huge difference between that Adlib device and, say, a Roland SCC1 or some other fancy General MIDI device hooked in with the parallel port. But I think at least with that, you did have a baseline expectation or a couple different ones. There was the, practically speaking, no sound capability besides that PC speaker. There was the Adlib / Sound Blaster. If that sounds acceptable, then you're okay. But even in those cases, you knew what those setups actually sounded like. With the ways that people are actually setting their surround sound systems, their sound bars, the way that people are able to do that or are not able to do it can be really quite unpredictable. I think I'm just really affected right now by the fact that I consider myself a pretty knowledgeable audio consumer, and yet I was just not able to make this thing sound the way that I wanted. It would, in fact, require me to make a decent investment in order to get this sound setup working to the way that the developers expected me to or would wish for me to hear their media. So, yeah, maybe I'll swing the other way later on, but right now I'm so impacted by this utter discrepancy that I don't think is really quite possible to be, I don't think this gap is possible to be bridged, except the way that I guess a lot of the console manufacturers are figuring out how to do it, which is through headphones. You know, Sony is pushing their headphones. They've got their wireless headphones. They've been talking about how binaural is the way. It's the future. And we're going to make it so that multiple players can have really cool binaural experiences with either the wireless headsets or their regular headphones that are plugged into their wireless controllers. So, yeah, I don't know.
The of course, Apple a few months ago were announcing the wonders of spatial audio for their for Logic and also for Apple Music, and the new AirPods, I think, which of course got a whole lot of people sort of suddenly clued in, interested in the possibilities and the potential for spatial audio applications in music. Yeah, I wonder.
That's really exciting. Just all those demos that are available, and also people talking about the different music that's now available on Apple Music that you can actually listen to with really nice AirPods or the AirPod Max, and you can actually experience the spatiality, and the audio is kind of interactive in that way. Kind of neat.
Yeah, I think it's when it comes to headphones, it's sort of an easier solution for this kind of thing than surround setups. I remember some years ago when I was first setting up my room here, which I have some acoustic treatment, which made a huge difference in the quality of sound that I got in this workspace that I'm in. I remember a friend asking me, this was a friend who hasn't really got much, not that much interest, but also not that much experience or knowledge with, you know, acoustic science or music production or sound production in general. And the question was really, really sort of innocently simple, but very, very confounding. He said, why do you bother putting all that effort into making such a good sounding room with your speakers if the majority of the people who are going to be consuming the music that you're making are going to be listening on crappy headphones or crappy speakers? Like, why bother? Like, what's the point of having good acoustics in your production space if nobody, or like a very, very small subset of the consumers who are going to be listening, are actually going to be able to appreciate what you're hearing when you're producing the stuff? And I actually, for a moment, was sort of stumped for an answer. I think in the end, I sort of basically fumbled through some kind of answer, like, you know, it having a good system in production means that we have like a sort of a benchmark that I know that in case there is a chance that somebody listens to my music on a set of headphones or a set of speakers that emphasizing a certain frequency that I'm not hearing when I'm producing, then at least I can catch that out at the mix process so that I know that what I'm sending that consumer is not going to have any offending, you know, really obviously offending problems in certain areas of the mix that my system is not able to replicate, but their system is. But in the case of headphones and, you know, just sort of two stereo speakers, it's not too bad. I mean, you can get some really, really poor, you know, crappy reproduction devices. But when you're talking about surround sound, just like you're saying there, Vince, it's quite a different world there, because you have the potential to really, really badly screw up the setup, which, I'm not saying that's what you've done, Vince, but you know, you do have the potential for basically kind of breaking the whole mix if your setup is not correctly arranged, which then means that headphones on the other end of the spectrum are quite a safe solution, aren't they? Because there's not very many ways to screw up the setup of headphones. You know, you put them on your head, basically.
Yeah. And I think in the audio domain, there's a lot of trust that needs to be put in these various systems in a way that we don't have with the visual. We don't have to worry about that. Especially nowadays when everyone has a flat panel, 4K, whatever, you know, a red pixel is a red pixel. A blue pixel is a blue pixel. And maybe there's some variance in there. Like, okay, you know, it doesn't quite get all the way to black because it's not an OLED. But it's, you know that it is, in as much as it can be, an unlit pixel, et cetera, et cetera. But on sound, there's so many different systems in play now. Not just on the low end, where everyone sort of understood that there will be compromises. Okay, here's a Dolby Atmos system, and there's going to be some computation in place to try to make that fit into this guy's headphones. But even on the high end, where people are paying $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 for surround sound setups that are not quite what the original channel setup was. It's not 5.1, it's not 7.1, because it eventually has to be mixed down or folded down to what? I'm looking at upgrading my particular sound setup to this kind of nice Sony setup. You know, it's more than $1,000 for a decent surround sound setup. It's a 4.0.4 setup. Okay. So what? It's like, yeah, it relies on, it's supposed to be absolutely excellent 3D. At least that is what the company says. And that is what various independent reviewers say. But still, it is four channels plus four height channels without a distinct center or subwoofer. Mm. Okay, that's different. How is it going to mix it? We kind of trust that it's going to mix it the right way. And by all accounts, it does it more or less the right way. Now, there are certain other systems that are out there that are like, maybe it will work out all right. I thought I had a pretty decent setup with my 12-channel wireless sound wireless soundbar plus subwoofer system. Then it's not a matter of the actual drivers that I have at my disposal, but the inability to cope with the standards and the bandwidth that are actually hampering me right now. Yes, a surround sound. I thought things would get better. It hasn't really gotten better. There's just more and more different things to deal with. So this whole ARC thing, this audio return channel, it didn't strike me that there would be an update to this system. I just sort of assumed that this system works because it worked in the past in the Xbox 360, Xbox One, PlayStation 4 days. It worked just fine for me. But now with Nintendo and their Nintendo Switch that does properly support surround sound, I need to get a slightly different setup and I have to probably invest a little bit more. Yay.
Mike, are you interested in exploring the possibilities, or have you explored the possibilities of spatial audio for your work in games or film?
I rarely set foot in the sound design side of things. It's not obvious to me how the technology is interesting or useful. Surround applications for music or spatial audio applications for music to me have seemed only interesting in a kind of laboratory way, or when the music is diegetic. You know, you're playing a game and you're walking around and there's a band in the corner in the game. And of course, you then need to embody the music as an entity with spatial position and all that. But I haven't ever heard, I'm trying to think if I'm lying or not. I don't think I've ever heard an interesting application of spatial audio to music. There was one musical I saw at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival where they had like a binaural microphone and the musicians were moving around it, and it was kind of cool, but it was mostly a novelty value thing. And I guess what I'm trying to say is no. But my heart is totally open. If somebody shows me an interesting application of spatial audio to music, I'm all game for expanding the scope of what I think is artistically appealing.
I'm actually pretty interested in what surround versions of my soundtracks could sound like. You know, since I do have quite a few tracks that are really trying to be that orchestra inside of a concert hall, that experience. And I do have a lot of various facilities for outputting multi-channel or surround sound formats of that music. One of the plugins that I have is called Mir, which is a product from Vienna that stands for multi-impulse response for various environment. So I can actually set up my virtual listener inside of this concert hall or other recording venue and record not just what's going on in front of me, but also the sound in back of me as well, and what's reflecting off of the back walls. And the little bit that I've tried of that inside of, say, you know, a Sony Santa Monica colleague's office with their really nice blue sky monitoring system, you know, full 5.1 or whatever it was. Actually, I think it's a 7.1 system now. You know, hearing that actually sounds kind of awesome. And it really helps with the immersion and the sense of the reality, or at least the verite of the music being performed, which is certainly something that I'm striving for with my soundtracks, or at least that's one aspect of it. So I'm actually kind of excited about that.
It's really really fascinating. I think in my domain, where I'm mainly, you know, in the electronic domain, I personally have enough trouble making interesting music in stereo, let alone in you know, engulfing the listener in some kind of surround environment. I think I sort of agree with you. I have a similar feeling that you do, Mike, that it's very fascinating from a sort of laborious, yes, indeed. it's fascinating, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, listening and experiencing the different kinds of things that people do with spatial audio and music. However, at face value, for me, it feels like kind of, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm very much looking forward to seeing how people experiment with the emotional applications of this beyond just, oh, that sounds like it's coming from over there. There's a synth part behind me. Oh, the bass is underneath me. Or, you know, there's a pad on top of my head. Or the hi-hats are over that way somewhere. You know, beyond that sort of, you know, novelty aspect of it, of things just being in different places instead of just a stereo field, the emotional, you know, the emotional benefits of doing this from a musical point of view. I guess I'm not very curious myself to experiment with that, but I am very looking forward to experiencing what other people come up with.
I think in any technology in audio, and arguably any technology in any domain, the two questions are, what is possible and who cares? And I think the what is possible side is always fascinating from an intellectual standpoint, but the benefits of technology have to trickle down to the who cares level for it to be artistically meaningful.
Well said.
Have you ever had a particular surround sound moment that struck you or stuck with you in a game or a film?
Nope.
Oh, wow, that was quick. Decisive. No.
Okay. I think the answer is yes, but maybe not in the way that was intended. Because occasionally I'll be in a theater watching a movie, and there'll be some very ostentatious use of spatial audio, like some helicopters crashing in an MCU movie, and we hear it kind of behind us, you know, like 270 degrees behind our right ear, and it's kind of moving in some way that feels like maybe there is actually a helicopter crashing on Victory Boulevard outside. And there is a kind of realism imparted by these effects, but I'm so aware of the intention of the movie to create that effect that I find it distracting.
Exactly the same. I feel exactly the same. The other thing that I always find very difficult to wrap my brain around with, you know, the cinema experience and how surround sound is used in that context is the fact that, you know, if I'm looking at a scene, it's on a big flat screen in front of me and somebody knocks on the door and you hear it behind, you know, you hear it behind your head. I cannot detach myself from the fact that I'm just sitting here looking at a big screen and it's all in front of me. It's right there. You know, it's not, there is nobody behind me because it's all on a screen in front of me. So even when I'm at, you know, if you go to like IMAX or the like really, really huge screen, for me personally, I find it quite difficult to detach myself from the physical place that I am and the physical medium in front of me, which is just a big flat screen. So like Mike said, I agree entirely that when that happens, when you get sounds coming from behind you in a cinema, for me personally, it sort of stands out too much as kind of, yeah, okay, well done, sound designers. You've got sounds coming from behind me. Nice job. You know, rather than, oh my God, this is so scary. I feel like I'm actually in the room with these actors and there's something behind me. How could you be in the room with these actors? They're gigantic on this massive screen in front of you. I don't know. I guess I'm a tough nut to crack in terms of immersion.
Okay. So I guess that makes me the odd one out. I definitely have some strong memories of surround sound use in film. Probably the most recent one that just really utterly wowed me would probably be Gravity, which I had the opportunity to see at the Cinerama Dome. Mm. I guess now I'm feeling sad because the Cinerama Dome is now closed down, one of the casualties of the pandemic. Hopefully someone can be a new tender to that space because it's a wonderful space and the surround sound experience there is absolutely fantastic. And I found Gravity to be incredibly engrossing and the sound of that film was just beautiful, not just technically impeccable, but also really moving. I found that despite the ultra wide presentation of the film, it really was the sound that actually sold the space of that world for me. And that is just one of those films that really, really sticks with me even now. It's been a few years, but I feel like it's really been, it feels like it was just yesterday, honestly. That film was fantastic. But perhaps I'm just a little too sensitive to some of those particular tricks. Like even when I was a kid, a teenager, I'm going to say something really silly, but there was this very dumb film called Conspiracy Theory, which it's really just a pretty standard kind of schlocky Mel Gibson. It's actually a pretty well done film, if pretty slight, but there's some particularly great moments of surround sound and it's highlighted by good editing, good timing. It's a pretty straightforward film, but they definitely lull you into spaces and you're focused in on particular points on the screen. And then they grab your attention off the screen with effective surround sound use. And I still remember things like that. I feel like surround sound definitely hits me pretty hard. And I'm kind of excited to keep on going with that, not just with sound effects, but even with music mixing in the future.
Cool.
That's a very super short coda. It's sad that I think the environments that are most capable of conveying surround sound to us right now are, I think, movie theaters or commercial environments where we would go somewhere for an experience. But perhaps where it's most artistically useful is in games, because in games there is more of a sense of you and you having a spatial relationship to the world. Whereas in films, the I'm not trying to take a dump on Vince's stories of Conspiracy Theory, but generally in films, you dissolve, like you are transparent. You forget yourself if the movie's really good. Whereas in games, there's much more of a sense of you as a spatially positioned actor. So it's too bad that the environments that are most capable of delivering this are the ones where it's the media where it's less effective.
Mm-hmm. I definitely understand that. I am not part of Gravity. That is not me on the screen experiencing that. But it does help for getting me wrapped up in this other person's experience. And yeah, let's see how it goes for games. I think there are some cool experiences that are worthwhile in game history when it comes to surround sound. Things like Chronicles of Riddick did some very interesting things with surround sound and extensive use of the rear channels and the center channels and in order to get the player into Vin Diesel's head, literally. And there aren't that many examples of that in history these days. Maybe it's because, the setups that we have are just so multitudinous now. And it's kind of scary to do something that leans on surround sound a little too much.
Mm.
Wow. We've been going at it for basically a full hour. Maybe we should try to cut it off shortly. But before we do that, has anyone been playing anything cool lately? any conspicuous consumption happening?
Yes, my company Moomode, we recently released our game Space Folk City, which we will talk about in the future episodes. But in order to sort of distract myself from the stress of doing that, I've been consuming a lot of movies recently in the evenings. And I watched one from, I think it was this year. It might have been last year or this year. It was a Peter Jackson movie called Mortal Engines. Unfortunately, famous because it was a colossal flop, losing something like $100 million or something, not only because of the pandemic, but also because of, it's not that great. But there's some redeeming aspects of it. And one of those is the sound design is very, very good. Very imaginative, very very creative, just very fun sound design. You know, often the sound designers were taking a very non-obvious route when, you know, here's this sound. Should we do this? No, let's not do what you would expect it to sound like. Let's make it sound like that. And there's a lot of examples of that through the movie, which are quite entertaining. So, yeah, I would recommend if you have the opportunity to see Mortal Engines, don't expect too much. But the sound design is very fun.
Okay, that sounds cool. I remember seeing the trailers for that. And I would like to check it out in the future.
I don't think I've heard of that one.
I guess that's a testimony to how much of a colossal flop it was.
I was going to say on my end, I went to a theater recently and saw Dune, which I thought was fantastic. I thought this was the first science fiction or science fiction-ish movie that I've seen in a long time, at least on the big screen, that I thought really was stirring and created a sense of a well-thought-out world, which I think in these days in science fiction and superhero movies, et cetera, is an increasingly rare phenomenon. The score was, I have to give credit where credit is due. The score was not musically interesting. Like if you listened to it outside of the context of the movie, I think it would sound stock in some ways, you know, like science fiction is a lot of tritone chord progressions, but in context, it was super effective, both in terms of the timbres and the Hans Zimmer production of the super richness that spreads across the entire audio spectrum and the timing of music to the particular visuals, and it imbued the film with this sense of grand significance, even when just two dudes were talking. There was this just constant sense of gravitas that I really loved. So I recommend the film both as a movie, but as a cinematic musical experience.
Is that Hans Zimmer who did the soundtrack for that?
It was indeed.
Our mate Hans, he's been keeping busy, hasn't he?
I like to say that a lot of his scores sound like he fell asleep on his keyboard, but the keyboard happened to be plugged into a really cool patch.
I always like to think of Hans Zimmer as the Tom Cruise of movie scoring. You know, it's just good value. You know, it's like it's not going to blow you away, but you know what you're getting into when you see a Tom Cruise movie. You know, it'll be good. It's just good value. And it's the same with Hans Zimmer's scores. It's like, yeah, you kind of know what you're getting into. It's just like good value. Yeah, it works. It's good, you know.
George Thorogood once described his band as like, yeah, the music we make is a cheeseburger, but it's a really good cheeseburger. And there's definitely a role for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of really good cheeseburgers, I think that's a really apt comparison for something like No Time to Die, which is the most recent Bond film, also scored by Hans Zimmer.
Oh, really?
It's a James Bond film, and I would say it's an excellent entry into the James Bond series. I thought the music was really quite good, not just because of the actual music there, but also some really nice use of callbacks to earlier films. So they do these really interesting callbacks to the theme from Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which I actually was really impacted by, because that is actually one of my very favorite Bond films. I wonder how other viewers might be, especially people who are not as clued in on the entirety of the Bond lore. But I thought it was actually a really well done film that takes into consideration not just Bond in this current iteration, but also how Bond has been treated in various films in the last few decades. I liked it a lot.
Interesting that you describe that as a good entry point. It's kind of ironic considering that it's Daniel Craig's last, like this is the changing of the guard, so to speak, the transformation of the Doctor into a new Doctor Who. This is the end of the season, in a sense, for Daniel Craig's run. So it's interesting, ironic that would be an interesting entry point. It's actually an end point of sorts, but yeah, interesting.
Well, I mean, that's the way it is with so many series, right? You can't expect every person to just go into a series saying, okay, I want to get into Star Trek. What should I do? Well, you have to watch Christopher Pike in this pilot. No. It's just not reasonable. You have to get in there, you know, somewhere else along the line. And hey, this is a really good film. And I enjoyed it. Dune is next on my list, so I'm looking forward to seeing what all the talk is about soon enough.
Cool.
Please let us know next week how you felt about it, because I'm kind of curious.
All right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. But until that time, we have to say bye to episode 213 of the Game Audio Hour. If you liked this podcast, please feel free to like and subscribe on the various services where we are available. That includes things like Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and a smattering of other places. Go ahead and leave us a review if you feel so inclined. Also, you can follow us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, where we will post updates on when the next episode drops. And until that time comes, bye.